listening to By the Well, a lectionary-based podcast for preachers recorded on the land of the Wurundjeri people. Hi everyone, I'm Fran Barber.
And I'm Kylie Crabb. And today we're going to be speaking to you about the readings for the third Sunday after Pentecost. We'll be talking about 2 Kings chapter 2, verses 1 to 2 and 6 to 14, Galatians chapter 5, verse 1 and then 13 to 25, and Luke 9, 51 to 62. And one of the things we're going to find out, I reckon, is that these readings all in their own sort of different ways draw in questions of discipleship, the experience of call to discipleship, resistance to that call, staying in a life of discipleship, and also even what we might think of as the fruit of a life of discipleship. So all this stuff mushed together across the course of our conversation. So delving straight in then, starting with the 2 Kings reading. Fran, do you want to give us a bit of context about what's going on in the broader narrative here?
Okay, well, we've last heard from Elisha in 1 Kings 19, four chapters ago, and he was approached, called, to be Elijah's disciple. And we'll see some echoes with the Luke reading because Elisha was out ploughing the field when he was called and he had the mantle of cloak thrown on him. And he said to Elijah, look, I just need to go home and kiss my parents and so on. Yep. And Elijah let him do that, whereas, as we know well from the Luke 9 reading, that isn't what Jesus says to the disciple who wants to go and do the same thing. We haven't heard anything from Elisha since then, but what we do have in the intervening chapters is a reminder of the really, I mean, the context of strife going on in the history of Israel at the moment, yeah, where Israel believes that their salvation lies in having a king or the right kings in charge. Mm. And Yahweh really, from their perspective, is behind the scenes, and not, whereas Yahweh is remaining faithfully in covenant with his people, with God's people, but they are not holding up to that covenant and believing the kings are their salvation. And so this call of, or this passing of the mantle of Elijah onto Elisha, and this the task of prophecy is occurring, is urgent, and life and death, literally. And so we know that's the sort of much more, that's the much broader history of redemption context that we're in.
Yeah. Nice. And so then in this passage we have all of these, it's quite a dramatic passage,
oh, it
right?
Is.
All this stuff going on.
I know. I mean, that's one way you could really run with it. In terms of preaching and, you know, how is Elijah dying here? Is he dying? You know, he's rushed. Yeah. You know, some of us want to just go to sleep peacefully when we're 150 or something, or, you know, others of us want to be in our prime and then just not know about it and all of that. And here he's sort of, there's a whirlwind, and he goes, well, straight to God and bypasses the grave perhaps.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, quite dramatic.
It becomes like actually a really important image that later people will work with, this idea of Elijah just kind of ascending, ascending on this chariot, and this idea of, I mean, we might use language right about like transcendence and stuff, this experience of a kind of like somebody moving between the heavenly realm and the earthly realm, which will become important for kind of people who are finding language for kind of mystical experience and stuff later on. We'll talk about these kinds of traditions as a kind of way of, engaging with God during human life.
Yeah. So the whirlwind's mentioned here, and we're familiar with the whirlwind in Job a couple of times. That's a whirlwind which is a revelation, like God appears much more explicitly in that context, I think, whereas here it's just the context in which Elijah goes up.
Yep.
Like there's no epiphany as such.
Or it's sort of part of like a cosmic drama.
Yeah,
or
cosmic
something.
Drama. That's good.
Yeah, yeah. There's kind of like action going on.
So you've mentioned one sort of boundary crossing, I guess, the heaven and the earthly one, but there's a couple of others going on here too, I think. We find in the first couple of verses that two places, Gilgal and Bethel, which I suppose both hold significance for, to put it in summary form, the fractured history of Israel.
Yes.
And that that the promise of God and of these prophets is that this will be healed and restored in some sense now. So there's a geographical movement going on, and then there's also a generational one of Elijah to Elisha. So quite a bit of movement.
Yes, yeah. That's great. And I mean, we've touched on a couple of them there with the intertextual link to with the whirlwind and Job. And we've also got here a bit of an intertextual link with Moses as well, yeah? With
yeah.
Striking water and...
And Joshua as well, crossing the Jordan. So This is really dripping with references and... import from Israel's history, and the first hearers would have made all those connections that we perhaps don't automatically make.
Yeah.
And there is, I mean, you know, just to think, there is the whole idea of ascension as well.
Yes.
For Christians in hearing this story as well.
Yes. Yep. Which is going to come out in our Luke reading when we get to that as well.
Mm. So I suppose Elisha resists. Elisha commits to staying with Elijah, but Elijah three times tries to make him not do that, which is a bit curious. And just at the level of narrative, maybe that's just Elijah testing Elisha's commitment. Mm. I don't know. That's a part of that whole staying with discipleship. You've been invited in or called in. What's going to keep you there, or what's going to persuade you perhaps to shift your attention to something more interesting?
Mm.
Yep. And the other curious thing in those first few verses, well, getting into 6 to 14, is the 50 men of the company of prophets, which I couldn't find a huge – I mean, folks go out there and, of course, you do your reading, but not a lot of clarity on what that might mean. So I wondered whether, you know, this is in the context, I suppose, of a drama, and that Israel has its kings and its armies, and so does Yahweh for the covenant and the fulfillment of God's people.
Yeah, yep. And I guess potentially also, because you can see as you get then into verse 12 with Elisha keeping watching and crying out, "Father, Father, the chariots of Israel and its horsemen," like you get this idea potentially of... sort of mimicking the imagery of other kinds of military groups or something, and that there's there's all this kind of complexity to the political world that you've already drawn out for us, Fran. That and that there's a sense in which divine order is being described here in a way which we might wonder about, really, that mimics that kind of structure, but I guess communicates to readers the kind of power of God and the kind of transcendence of God's armies here, if that's how that's we're conceptualizing.
Yeah, and I think the other key point perhaps for preaching and meditating on our own discipleship individually and as a community, as a church, is that Elisha does see, there's a perceiving or a seeing that Elisha has. So I'm leaping ahead a bit, but he asks for the double inheritance, which sounds presumptuous to us perhaps, but actually that he's just operating within his Hebrew inheritance laws, or Israel's inheritance laws, which were that the first son did inherit twice what everyone else in the family inherited. And so he's just asking, he's just saying, "I'm up for it." And, you know, but also that he does see the difference. He does see God's reality, and that's that perception, and that's what Elijah says. Like, it's actually not about whether I can give you that. It's whether God can.
Yeah.
You know, will you have the gift of faith and sight and understanding? You know, I don't know. He doesn't say I don't know, but essentially he's saying it's about grit and determination, but it's about the Spirit of God.
Yeah. Good stuff.
Is there anything that struck you in particular about it when you were...
I think I mostly noticed the intertextual links that we've talked about, and just thinking about, you know, like what do we do with passages like this that potentially are giving a complex picture of, you know, maybe It doesn't go as far as kind of divine warfare, though we do get passages that do that. But just thinking about historically contextualizing that, and what's the claim that lies behind this, which is about the authority of God in a way, I think.
Mm. I mean, a verse that also, just before we move on to the next passage, the verse that really leaps out to me too is verse 14. He took the mantle of Elijah that had fallen from him and struck the water. Where is the Lord, the God of Elijah? That question, where is the Lord, where is God, which is, you know, the question of a life of faith.
Yeah.
And there's a whole lot of stuff there about, well, there's at the level of the text, is it because he had to hit it twice, the water, before anything happened? Or is it that very real experience in transitions and change and uncertainty? That is our question.
Yeah.
And being faithful to God is trusting that God is there in some way and waiting for that appearance.
But there's something, I mean, I was also thinking about this and thinking like how much you want to do a kind of reader response on like, you know, what this makes us think about our generational changes in our churches and stuff like that. But it sort of part of what I also think is interesting, he asks that question as he's doing something which is very Moses. So he's got this kind of, in fact, there is this thing about, you know, the God of Elijah, but also the God of Elisha, you know, like the God of the current generation as well as the previous one. And in fact, as well as the God of Moses' generation that brings them out of Egypt. So, you know, like how are we reflecting on that in terms of how we call on our tradition and reinterpret our tradition in new settings? You know, it is the tradition and it is a new setting. So how does that interact as we look at generational change?
Yeah, no, that conversation really live. And I think this text really can bring that to the fore. So we come to Jesus' hard call to follow. Is that the right way of putting it, Kylie? Perhaps you won't agree. I don't know.
Well, there's definitely hard bits in it. Hey, this is like a super famous, it begins with one of the kind of like famous verses from Luke, well, famous among Lucan scholars. Not everybody's probably like, see, it's not like a John 3:16 kind of scenario, but if you speak to someone who studies Luke, they will know Luke 9:51 just immediately off the top of their head, because this is this kind of total turning point in the story where Jesus sets his face, it says, towards Jerusalem. It's the beginning of what we might call the travel narrative, this big central section of Luke's gospel between here and when he arrives in Jerusalem in chapter 19. And there's like endless debate amongst scholars about whether there's any kind of order to this or if it's kind of like a mishmash of things. But I think most people would say that there is some order, but people have certainly looked for millions of different parallels, including, you know, showing Deuteronomy coming through it and whatnot. And I'm not sure we want to go into subscribing for one of those very detailed plans, but to say, you know, there is something, this gives a real structure to Luke's gospel that having sort of established Jesus's ministry and stuff in the first 9 chapters, and we've just not long had the transfiguration, a couple of little conflicty narrative things in between, and then Jesus sets his face to go to Jerusalem. And in fact, we get this stuff straight afterwards where he's not received because he's got his face set towards Jerusalem.
Well, I learned a bit there because I read up a bit about why would that be the case, and so learned a bit about the Samaritans and that after the 922, when the kingdoms were divided, there were some people left in Samaria and they were Yahweh-worshipping believers who had their own version of the Pentateuch and worshipped in their own temple on Mount Gerizim. Is that how you pronounce it? And then there were others who were in Jerusalem. And so therefore, when they hear that he set his face towards Jerusalem, they're not interested in him.
Well, yes. So, but there's also this overturn. I mean, from the just before the Transfiguration, of course, we start getting passion predictions. So it's not all like nice and, you know, sort of, you know, magic miracles and stuff. It's turning into a story of costly discipleship, which will be, it'll be costly for Jesus, but it'll be costly for those who follow him, as we get in this passage as well. So that could be part of what's going on. But the Samaritan stuff, exactly, it's so interesting because, of course, in only a chapter or so, we'll get the story of the Good Samaritan. And there's this thing, I mean, sometimes we can have a tendency to say, it's like, you know, like the Samaritans are like a totally separate group. But actually what's going on here is it's, I mean, it's partly that, but it's all within the same tradition, right? So this is like a kind of, if you've got sort of insiders and you've got outsiders well, here you've got a kind of like outsider within the insider group, right? So it's, and which of course, as we know, can be some of our most passionate disagreements are among those who are kind of close, close-ish, but not, you know, from a different faction within our own little group, right? So that's, yeah, that's definitely part of what's going on here.
And, you know, their response, should we just burn them?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
not so much.
I was, no, I was just thinking that our reactivity, especially in social media, our culture of outrage, our
cancelling,
our assurance that we're right. I mean, it's all there in that that one line. And Jesus just redirects the attention, actually focus on what the task at hand is, you know, which is following me, what you're called to do, and do not be doing that. And, you know, there's so much in this passage, Kylie, but if you've been perhaps in a congregation for dozens of years and you haven't actually focused a sermon on that little exchange there, it's got quite a lot in it, I think.
It does. And there's also, I mean, like, it's helpful because we've got a bit of a steer in this direction from the lectionary and having already looked at the 2 Kings passage, which also relates to the section Fran was talking about in 1 Kings 19 when Elisha's first called. But, you know, like there's these intertextual links here that, of course, the first readers are also going to notice. So the raining down fire thing, this is Elijah. But we've got this sort of stuff that is showing over and over again this kind of prophetic overtones in the sense of this is the kind of material we would expect of prophets. And Jesus is being shown in this kind of way. And yet in a bigger way as well.
Yeah, there's a continuity here, folks. Don't worry. This has not come from nothing.
Yes.
But it's really not what you're expecting. It's totally different. Yes. And pay attention.
Yeah. So you flagged for us before the thing about the let me go say goodbye to my folks. And Elijah just lets him do that. So what do you notice here then in Luke 9?
Well, there's none of that dallying, dilly-dallying around. I mean, initially that claim, I'll follow you wherever you go, and Jesus sort of says, well, actually, I've got nowhere. That means Jerusalem, and I've got nothing more precise to offer you about it than that. You know, these other creatures have places to go, but this is not the same as that, and it's hard.
Yeah.
And, you know, the apparently cruel thing, let the dead bury their own dead. I don't know.
There's an urgency.
There's an absolute urgency. When you think about how quickly people needed to be buried in Jewish culture too, that's very, you know, that is a statement of urgency. And then, you know, not being allowed to say farewell to your loved ones.
Yeah.
And it put me in mind, I caught an episode of Compass on the ABC here in Australia, and for those outside Australia, it's a half-hour program on the life of faith and religion in Australia broadly, but it was about this amazing Indigenous guy called Professor Jack Beetson, who's a Ngemba man and the first Aboriginal Australian to complete a university degree in adult education. And he got it through TRANBY, which was an adult Aboriginal literacy and study place in Sydney. And Jack ended up, he's devoted his life to literacy education in the Indigenous community, and not surprisingly, he himself in the 1960s was at the, you know, he suffered in the mainstream system from terrible racism. He chose to do history and economics, and they said, oh well, no, that's not what Indigenous kids study, and you know, that was school for him. But he went back and he's taught young people, you know, how to read and write and so on. But part of the conversation with him was him talking about acquiring a mentor or being offered an older Indigenous man offered to mentor him and said, but you think about it because the struggle must come first. You think about that.
Yeah.
And Jack retells that he did think about that and he said to them, his mentor, yeah, the struggle will always come first. And I've never regretted that, he says. But part of his reflection now is the sort of sacrifice that his children and wives have made in his being absent. And it's just a really, in terms of the costliness of what yeah. we're seeing expressed in this reading from Luke, it was just quite timely that it's a really worthwhile program to go and listen to. He's been recognised with a UN award and so on. But that costliness of yeah. putting something well, and he talks about it in religious terms, actually, the struggle.
Mm. Fantastic. It sounds great. I guess you know, like there's this tension as we kind of read and reread these gospel stories all the time that we trivialize some of the struggle that comes first in that, or the, you know, we know that in Luke when the disciples are first called, it says they leave everything. It's just in Luke that everything is mentioned. And so it sort of runs as a thread through all of this. But like, what does that mean when we're looking at this? And what's the challenge in it as we orientate ourselves to this costly call? How it fits with a wider discernment of our discipleship and the moments where you weigh the cost. Maybe that's what your story you're describing just sounded like. Yeah.
And even at the time, like he weighed the cost and he said that, but then I didn't know. And we don't know, do we? No. We don't know.
No, that's right.
Part of this week too, I have been meditating a bit on some of Rowan Williams' work on. He's got a little book called Being Disciples, and he actually meditates on discipleship as it comes through in John's gospel. So it's about abiding and staying. It's very different sort of expression, which is a lot easier to, I mean, easier. It's a lot more approachable, I think, than this sort of leave everything. You know, he talks about being an awareness and an expectancy that characterizes your life when you seek to be in the company of Christ. And he talks about it being like bird watching, so that you spend a lot of your time faffing around in the rain, kind of waiting. Yeah. But it's about noticing and committing and a decision every day. And, Luke's is a hard word in comparison with that sort of an evocation of discipleship, I think.
Yeah. But there's also something about like that the whole thing is shot through with this kind of orientation, right? It's a readiness to relativize the things that we might automatically hold dear or something. Not totally to just let go of that stuff, but to a readiness to see things from that perspective, which in the moment might involve leaving everything to follow, but might also be just as costly actually in the kind of bird watching scenario where you are deliberately orientating yourself to look for something different in the world. And as it comes up, you might at different times, there'll be a different call about what you do next. But the same call is that you're always looking for that kind of push from God or something.
Yeah,
you know,
like that prompt.
Present.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean. And I guess the story is, you know, even here in this really costly kind of passage with Jesus and his disciples, the trade-off is that they're with Jesus on the way.
He's there with them. Yeah. I think we probably need to move on to the Galatians passage just before we finish up.
Can I say one other thing about the Luke thing?
Oh, go ahead.
Just that in all the intertextual links and stuff, and we've got a few here, something to do with, you know, the stuff we've already mentioned about Elijah, but there's also some stuff from Ezekiel about the Son of Man setting his face and that kind of stuff, which also links us back in other ways to the Transfiguration narrative where we've got Moses and Elijah, both characters who kind of have mysterious disappearances at their end of their lives in one way, and sort of draw out this prophetic stuff. Jesus is being presented as a prophet, but as we said, more than a prophet. Mm. But he's also being set up to be a prophet who'll be rejected, and that is a key theme across Luke since since he inaugurated his ministry in chapter 4, but it is a particular theme of this travel narrative where there'll be further discussion about the passion predictions and the disciples kind of not getting stuff, and then and this sense of escalating conflict and rejection of the one who's been commissioned to bring the good news.
Yeah, part of the hardness of the call to discipleship then is that you are living for this new reality which is rejected by the world and therefore puts you at odds with the world. So that perhaps leads us into the Galatians where we find out that freedom isn't what we thought. We think being called, such as the disciples in Luke here, that is a curtailing of our freedom.
Mm.
First I've got to go and do this and sort out stuff and then I'll, you know. But no, this is actually true freedom.
Yeah.
So this passage, I suppose, goes into the area you mentioned very first up, which is about the fruits of the fruits of committing to stay in this mode of discipleship.
I mean, Galatians, we've been in the lectionary following bits and pieces of Galatians through. It's a fully feisty letter, right? Mm-hmm. It's really polemical. Paul has things to say. It's like he's written it, you know, as soon as he's heard there's a certain kind of news, and it's really, I mean, there's loads of biblical scholarship about it that tries to work out how much you can really tell about the situation that lies behind it from Paul's cross letter. We only get one half of the debate, right? But certainly there's been some kind of falling out, and it relates to something to do with the communal expression of faith and groups that have come from somewhere else to say, oh, if you're going to be a proper Christian, then you also need to keep certain dietary laws, which means you can't all be eating together. So and then this is what's outraged Paul, that there would be people sort of fracturing the Christian community and eating separately. So we get this. So this is why it's, you know, it's got this stuff about, you know, for freedom Christ has set us free, and so we should stand firm in this and not fall back into slavery. And it's got these really strong contrasts that have been very controversial that we need to be careful with about misrepresenting the Judaism of this period, especially remembering that Paul himself is a Jew and that there's lots of diversity amongst Jewish people, practices, traditions of this time. It's not like Christianity versus Judaism.
No, but it can be. It's depicted quite often that way, so yeah.
Yeah, exactly, a thing to be careful of. But so then thinking, Fran, about the fruit that we're talking about, do you want to – what sort of strikes you about what Paul is saying here and what this might mean for discipleship?
Well, I mean, the one that's most offensive perhaps to a late modern Western ear is the whole need for self-control. I mean, although we have a funny relationship with that, I think. Like, we feel oppressed by the notion that we need to have self-control because life is about our choice and fulfillment. And, you know, I'm being exaggerating here, but only a bit. And, you know, other people mostly represent curtailing my own fulfillment and all of that. So we resist that notion. But then on the other hand, we do have all this advertising about dieting. And so there's a funny relationship there. But I think that's something that is interesting to explore about what a God-centered you know, the God-centered nature of discipleship and what that asks us to put aside.
Yeah. I think, it's interesting, right, when you look through the verses here, there's what we would describe as like a vice list, as in this is a thing you get in the ancient world, a list of vices, things not to do, and then you get this other stuff that is the things that are the fruit of the Spirit, and the self-control is listed there under one of the fruits of the Spirit. And I think one of the other things I think these are totally worth reflecting upon and thinking about what a life that responds to discipleship might grow and flourish into. But one thing I would just put in as a kind of thing to wonder about, I think self-control there is also about self-control of emotions, of the passions. And so what we see as well is Paul being a bit of a stoic.
Capital S. Philosopher.
The philosopher, stoicism, and wanting to control emotions and affect. That's part of, I mean, that which of course we should contextualise and remember that that is part of the kind of cultural fabric of his philosophical world. seeping into how he's describing good Christian life. And we might actually might want to challenge some of those things and think about, well, actually, we're not just having a particular – I mean, because this also links to other things like first century attitudes towards masculinity, what a proper man should be doing. And we might say, well, there are some – that's worth thinking about. And also, what do we think is – are the kind of masculinities that we think are healthy and faithful and that we want to kind of portray to the world and not just masculinities, but that's where we might find a challenge. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. No, I hadn't thought about that aspect of it. Well, I think it's time to probably finish up now, but I think, yeah, focusing on those fruits as a way of closing. And
The little phrase in there, you know, it says twice stuff about keeping step. So walking with the Spirit, and then it comes back to it, keeping step with the Spirit. I reckon you could do well to just have a week where you contemplate what does it mean to keep step with the Spirit.
Thanks for listening.
By the Well is brought to you by Pilgrim Theological College and the Uniting Church in Australia. It's produced by Adrian Jackson. Thanks for listening.